Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It's Monday, October 24th, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week by supporting the show in the many ways that you do, especially those of you who visited www.patreon.com/talknerdy or visited my website, karasantamaria.com, and clicked through on the Patreon button. Specifically, I want to thank Phil T-Bear, Ron Canoblock, Pedro Rosario Barbosa, Stuart Ogg, Charles Payet, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, The Honorable Husband, Brian Holden, Jafe, and Jeffrey Sewell. Thank you so much. Without you, the podcast would absolutely not be possible. All right, guys, I'm a little under the weather having come back from Manchester recently. I think I caught something on the plane. So I'm going to keep this short and sweet, but I'm really excited about this week's episode. I had an opportunity to sit down with Simon Singh. He's a journalist, an author, a television producer, and was trained as a particle physicist. And he's a big math enthusiast, as you can tell through many of his books, including The Code Book, The Simpsons and Their Mathematical Secrets, The Big Bang, Trick or Treatment, and more. All right, guys, without any further ado, here he is, Simon Singh. Well, Simon, thank you so much for sitting down with me to talk nerdy today.
My pleasure.
So, probably the last time that I saw you in person, I think may have been at a TAM.
Yes, maybe TAM 3 or 4 years ago, maybe.
Yeah, it's very hard for me to keep track. Yeah. But I saw you, I think, previous to joining with the Skeptics Guide. I know that you've also been on the Skeptics Guide to the Universe multiple times, right?
Yeah. 3 or 4 times. Maybe.
3 or 4 times, all of which were before I joined. So I'm very excited to be able to sit down and have a one-on-one with you. I feel quite lucky. Steve is not running the show. I'm running the show. And we're here at QED in Manchester. You're not from Manchester.
No, I grew up in the West Country, the southwest of England, in a small town called Wellington, very rural. My family are from India, so my grandfather left India in the 1930s and settled in this odd, curious farming community. And I was born there, grew up there, went to college in London, in Cambridge, and then kind of back to London for the rest of my life.
So you're still in London now?
Yeah, London's home for me.
And is that mostly because that's where the work is?
So when I finished my PhD, I just realized I love physics. Physics is what I grew up wanting. I wanted to be a physicist. I wanted to make great discoveries. I wanted to crack the mysteries of the universe. And so I eventually completed a PhD. But when I got to the end of my PhD, I could see that I wasn't the best in my office, let alone the best in the world. So I loved physics, but I wasn't going to be a great professor. I wasn't going to be a great researcher. So I thought, what else can I do that keeps me close to science? I still love science, but tapped into my other skills. And I love television. I love teaching. I love talking about science. So when I finished my PhD, I applied to the BBC for a job. And I worked at the BBC for about 6 years, making science documentaries, science magazine, TV shows. And the BBC back then was much more based in London. Mm-hmm. It's now spread out. In fact, Manchester, where we are now, is probably the second biggest hub for media. But back then, if you wanted to do science, certainly London was the place to be. So that's kind of been home ever since.
You know, it's funny. I think that a lot of people who are probably listening to the show who know you by name, you know, the vast majority of my listeners are American listeners, but I do have a lot of listeners in the UK, Australia, and then into other, like, non-English-speaking countries, or non-primarily English-speaking countries. I think that those who are listening who know you by name know you because of your work in skeptical activism. They probably know you because of...
because of the work that you do in skepticism. And I wonder how many of them know that you are a particle physicist.
Yeah, an ex-particle
physicist. Hey, yeah. You earned the PhD. Yeah, I think you get to use the label the rest of your life, right?
I mean, but in between then, I mean, I made films at the BBC. I made one film, a documentary about Fermat's Last Theorem. Mm-hmm. And I still meet young professors now who say that they saw my film when they were teenagers and it inspired them into mathematics. After that, I've written about five books. I've written exactly five books. No more, no less. And I think those books, there are a lot of people who know me from those books. Mm-hmm. My first book was a number one bestseller. It was incredible to write a book about mathematics to be a runaway success.
And your most recent book is about, well, it's not about The Simpsons, but it's about all of the brilliant math in The Simpsons.
That's right. There's a lot of the writers on The Simpsons were mathematicians. And I mean, people who have PhDs, one guy was a professor at Yale. J. Stuart Burns was doing a pure mathematics PhD at Berkeley and quit that to join The Simpsons. So you have this gang of mathematicians who are no longer mathematicians, but they still love mathematics. And whenever they can squeeze some obscure bit of mathematics into the show, they do. So in the very first episode, in fact, of The Simpsons, there's a joke about calculus. In the previous season of The Simpsons, there was a reference to, in one scene, there was a reference to Gauss's formula for the distribution of primes. There was a formula about the Riemann hypothesis. There was a formula about the traveling salesman problem. There was something about Fermat's Little Theorem. So anyway, so there's a ton of math in The Simpsons. And those books, like cryptography, about cosmology, I think there's a group of people who really know me from those books, because the great thing about science is it translates. So I have publishers in Japan and Israel and South America, and that's fantastic. You know, mathematics and science is a universal language, and the same cosmology we have in the UK is applicable in India and the rest of the world. But then I suppose all of those books that we've talked about, I just ran through them, are really about celebrating science.
Sure.
Mathematics is amazing and cosmology is mind-blowing and cryptography is this amazing technology that's transforming the world. So my books are really about celebrating science. And then there just came a point when I thought, I began to get angry about pseudoscience. Mm-hmm. And so I gradually shifted away from celebrating terrific science, still love science, but I moved away from celebrating science and moved towards challenging bad science, challenging pseudoscience. So I suppose that's when I've shifted into the skeptical movement.
And of course, in my view, as kind of somebody who's a little more new to the skeptical movement, they really are two sides of the same coin. It's almost impossible, I think, to be a strong skeptic if you don't have a good grasp of the scientific method. And if you are a good scientist and somebody who really values and celebrates an understanding of the scientific method, by your very nature, you are a skeptic.
Yes. Yeah, I think you're right. If you have a scientific background, it helps enormously. But many scientists are oblivious to the world of pseudoscience. Many GPs, general practitioners, the kind of doctor you would go and see, a run-of-the-mill problem, they don't realize that there are these quacks out there who are actively working against the medical practitioner that you might see normally. Scientists in their labs have no idea about the weird pseudoscience that's going on. There are a few exceptions to that. Climate scientists know that there are climate change deniers.
That's true. When things become kind of politicized, they become a little more popular.
And doctors are aware of the anti-vaccine movement. Mm-hmm. But in general, scientists stay in their labs and they moan about science in the media and they moan a bit about pseudoscience, but they don't really do much about it. And on the other side, though, I would say there are some skeptics who have no scientific background at all. Mm-hmm. I've worked very closely with Michael Marshall. I think his degree was in English literature. He then went into marketing, I think. But over the course of the last decade, mm-hmm. his understanding and appreciation and passion for science and its impact on society is phenomenal.
Yeah, it's true.
It was interesting. When I worked in television, it was very similar. I clearly had spent a lot of time reading physics books and doing physics research, and that I would make programs about physics and mathematics. And I really felt that that helped me. But we had, you know, I made a documentary about Fermat's Last Theorem. I made it with a guy who had no mathematics background at all, mm-hmm. but was a brilliant filmmaker. So yeah, it's odd how it works.
And you also sometimes get the opposite experience, at least I have throughout my career, my much shorter career in American television, which is that you encounter many producers and many individuals who are endeavoring to make science programming but are less interested in the science per se. You know, this is, I think, a big cultural divide that's starting to bleed over, unfortunately. I think American ideas about what should appear on science channels is starting to bleed over into some television in the UK and Australia.
Yeah, I think the big debate in Britain in terms of science on television is the question of false balance.
Yeah.
So I'll be phoned up on a fairly regular basis and said, asked, do I want to appear on be interviewed about homeopathy for some reason? And I used to say, yes, sure, I'm very happy to put forward the skeptical point of view. Mm-hmm. But what happens is, I put forward my skeptical point of view, I'll have a homeopath on who'll sell homeopathy to the audience, the listeners. The interviewer will conclude, well, gosh, he says this and she says that. Maybe, what do you all think out there?
Yeah, it's always, you decide.
Yeah, 10 people ring in with their miracle healing stories of homeopathy, and the world is a worse place. So I no longer take part in those interviews. I no longer want to be the person that justifies a 5, 10, 15 minute slot about homeopathy.
Sure.
If there is a news issue about homeopathy, I will very happily talk about it because I'll very happily talk about it because it's an issue that we need to discuss. But I'm not just going to have debates with people because the one against one debate doesn't really reflect the science. We don't have time to go into it in the detail that's necessary to inform an audience so that they can make an informed view.
Have you, are you aware of the show on HBO that's been on for about 2 years now with John Oliver?
Yes. He looked at climate science.
Yeah, he did kind of a funny little segment about climate science, and he had something like 99 climate scientists and then one climate denier. He's like, this is a fair and balanced panel.
The BBC looked at this a few years ago. They asked Steve Jones, a professor of genetics, who also does a lot of media work and writes a lot of popular books. They asked Steve Jones to write a report about BBC science reporting. And I think his main criticism was this issue of false balance. Mm-hmm. The BBC is beginning to move forward slowly. But at the end of the day, if you're a TV producer, you want controversy. You want a program that's going to shock and interest. And that means having two sides of the debate, even if that one side of the debate represents only a tiny, tiny, tiny minority of pretty much non-expert opinion.
And ultimately, I think it's a fundamental kind of journalistic ideal, this idea of making sure that if we're going to present something to the public, we want to ensure that all of the aspects of what we're presenting are heard, which is incredibly dangerous in journalism, but often doesn't even apply in popular entertainment television. I mean, that's where I start to see the most egregious examples of anti-science, pseudoscience, bad science, especially on American TV. Famously, during Shark Week, there was a Discovery Channel quote-unquote documentary about megalodons still swimming in the seas, and a documentary about whether or not mermaids exist on a channel that ostensibly has some amount of authority in the eyes of individuals who maybe don't know the science behind some of these things. And I'm seeing that is an increasingly dangerous pattern in American TV. Do you notice something similar here in England?
Not so much. Not so much. I mean, I suppose the more worrying thing is that just the wild west of the internet, all of that stuff is out there to be discovered and explored. And if you don't really know much science, it's very easy to be bewildered and confused and led down the wrong path. In Britain, who presents you the information is really important. So, for example, there's a magazine here called What Doctors Don't Tell You. It used to be a website. So, sure enough, people would go to the website, What Doctors Don't Tell You, and the website essentially said, well, there are things that doctors don't tell you, and the reason they don't tell you is either because they're a bit stupid or because they're hiding things from you.
Yeah.
So you need to go and see your alternative healer. It was the basic message. Now, when it was on a website, it was a website, and there's not much we can do about it. But it then transformed itself into a magazine, really glossy, hats off to them, it was very well produced. And it became available in the mainstream supermarkets, newspaper department stores and so on. So people could just go and buy this magazine. And it would be next to quite serious magazine, serious health magazine.
Yeah, so there's an authority to it once it's kind of printed on paper. And
exactly.
There's a legitimacy that's
That's right, and
it.
It's being sold by reputable retailers in the UK, with people like WH Smith, and Tesco, Sainsbury's. And that's far more worrying because you know it's going to reach out to a whole new audience who will believe it much more because they bought it at WH Smith's and it was right next to New Scientist, perhaps.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that we tried to campaign in the UK to do was to have that removed from the shelves. And so we would write to the supermarkets and the shops and stores and say, look, this is a dangerous product. If your customers read this and act on it, the advice is so harmful in some cases. For example, there's a huge article they did about the dangers of the HPV vaccine, which would have scared many parents and young girls. So we tried to highlight that to supermarkets, and three of them removed it from their shelves. One of them then subsequently returned it to the shelf. But that was, I think, a very worthwhile effort on our part. You know, the magazine still exists. It's still being sold, but I don't think it's being sold in the numbers it used to be sold in. And that was important because it was reaching a new audience and had a new level of credibility as opposed to when it was a website. And I did receive some criticism, and other people who worked on this project as well received some criticism about
censorship.
This is a free speech issue, and if they want to publish their magazine and so on. If they want to publish their magazine, they are free to do that. I am not banning their magazine. I'm not suing them. I'm not taking them to court. But I'm a consumer at that supermarket, and I, as a shopper, have the ability to express my choice as well, which is to say, I don't think you should be able to do that. I don't think you should do that.
Yeah.
They're able to do it if they want to. And supermarkets, you know, there are a million magazines out there. And supermarkets do not stock every single magazine. They choose which ones they sell, and they choose which ones they don't. And so I'm trying to influence that choice in one direction, and the person who's making the magazine is trying to influence it in the other direction. And some of their readers may be influencing it in the other direction. So to me, that's a perfectly legitimate thing to argue for.
And I think it's an important kind of activist step. It's interesting when I read about you online and I kind of look at the trajectory of your career, and anybody, because this is a short interview, we obviously don't get to everything, but anybody who's interested, I definitely recommend, even on your website, you have this very colorful biography that talks about your parents and your grandparents, farming and then immigrating and your experiences as a young student and then going to college and then doing your research at the Large Hadron Collider, at CERN.
Yeah, it was the machine that was predated the Large Hadron Collider. Our machine now is a tiny little thing that feeds into the Large Hadron Collider. We're just the kind of...
looking for something that ultimately was discovered at Fermilab.
Yes, so we were looking for... There were six quarks that make up a large amount of the matter around us. And in fact, two of them make up most of the matter around us. But there are six of them. Five of them were known. The missing one was the supposed top quark. And we looked for it, and we were racing against the machine in outside Chicago, the Fermilab machine. And in the end, we were never going to win. Our machine just wasn't powerful enough. The top quark was so massive, we weren't really going to be able to produce it.
So if LHC had been completed and turned on, that would have been a totally different scenario. But you were at a smaller accelerator at CERN.
Yes, it's also the type of machine you're using and what you're smashing together and so on. But Fermilab, started creating top quarks in very large numbers, and we really ran out of steam. But it was an exciting adventure, and we learned some other stuff along the way.
And it's interesting, you know, you look at this kind of trajectory of your career going from a very heady, you know, scientific endeavor, moving over into media, which some people would argue is, you know, a more creative other side of the coin. You know, those of us who have worked in science and media know that they're both very creative endeavors. And then moving into this kind of skeptical activism, finding yourself involved in some movements. You know, you're talking about maybe a smaller movement of trying to get these pseudoscientific magazines off of a shelf, but you've also been involved in very large movements that have gotten you, I think, also a lot of media attention. Some people who have heard your name know you because of the lawsuit.
Yeah, I co-authored a book with Ed Zard Earn. Mm-hmm. People may have heard of Ed Zard. He was the world's first professor of complementary medicine. Very rigorous, a very good researcher, but who had chosen the field of alternative medicine. And so he looked at alternative medicine in a very rigorous fashion. He wanted to know which ones work, because a few of them do, which ones don't work, which is the majority, and which of them are actually dangerous. And there are quite a few of those as well. And he'd been doing that for years, as I say, the world's first professor of complementary medicine. I said to him, look, we should write a book. We should get your research out to everybody. You know, your research is really important, and we should get the message out to more people. And so let's write a book. So we wrote a book called Trickle Treatment. And when you write a book, you want people to know that it exists.
Sure.
Maybe go and read it.
You have to do the media around.
That's right. So we would give lectures, and we would give interviews and write articles. And I wrote an article for The Guardian newspaper, one of our national newspapers, about chiropractic. Mm-hmm. We had a whole chapter in the book about chiropractic. And I was criticizing particularly the fact that chiropractors often claim to treat children, often do treat children, claiming to treat things like colic and asthma and ear infection.
Things that probably require real medicine.
Exactly. You know, if a chiropractor wants to mess around with your back, that's okay, I suppose. You know, very hard to treat lots of back problems. I would avoid chiropractors because I think there are some risks there.
Yeah.
But you know, back problems, yeah, maybe fair enough. But for everything else, do not go near a chiropractor. I ended up being sued for libel for that article. And it was a miserable thing. It was a miserable case. It went on for 2 years. And for most of that period, it looked like I was going to lose. All the rulings, all the legal rulings went against me. Until the very last moment, I took it to the Court of Appeal, and we had three of the most powerful judges in the country, the Master of the Rolls, the Lord Chief Justice, Stephen Sedley, and together they ruled that actually I was correct. Mm-hmm. That as a science writer who was evaluating the evidence on a matter of public interest, that I should be allowed to say what I was saying.
And what was the basis for... So it was a libel suit.
It was a libel suit.
Was it a free speech? You know, Skeptics Guide is going through something similar. Steve Novella, more specifically, has been targeted. Obviously, I'm a bit satellite to that. And, yeah, there's this libel suit, but the basis there, I guess the argument from Tobinick was that Steve was doing these things in an effort to make money off of his site.
Yeah, I think the problem in the UK, mm-hmm. or in England and Wales, actually, our libel law is different from Scotland and Northern Ireland. Although it's a common problem, the problem is that the English libel law was horrendously one-sided. Hmm. It was very much developed over the course of a couple of hundred years to protect the reputations of the rich and the wealthy, the aristocracy, and so on.
Basically, if you say anything, even if it's true, if the person's powerful enough, they can kind of convince their way out of it.
Yeah, I think even if it's true, because libel laws were very one-sided, mm-hmm. and phenomenally expensive.
Yeah,
it was one of the most expensive areas of law. So, you know, an argument that may have damages of, say, £5,000, the legal costs could easily run into £1 million. And so somebody would say, I'm going to sue you, and the journalist might say, well, I know I'm right. And then the other person might say, well, okay, you want to put £1 million on the table to find out, at which point the journalist probably... backs down, or the local newspaper backs down because that could bankrupt them, or the academic journal backs down, or the blogger.
Yeah.
You know, what my case, and there were other cases as well, people may know Ben Goldacre, he was mm-hmm. being sued. He'd been sued just before I had. There were two or three cases of skeptics or scientists being sued, and And people became really aware that this law was horrendously one-sided. It was horribly expensive. And if scientists can't discuss the evidence, the British Medical Journal had been sued, Nature had been sued, and these were crippling cases.
Yeah.
The exact issue on mine was, I suppose it was two areas. One was I right to criticize chiropractors?
Mm-hmm.
Was my assessment of the evidence correct, or was I wrong? And I was very happy to debate that, discuss that, and take that to court. But the other issue, the one that really made it tough for me, was that the chiropractors were saying that I didn't just think they were wrong, but I thought that they were deliberately misleading the public.
Sure, that and they that's difficult.
That's right, because they claimed that I was calling them fraud.
Yeah.
That they knew that their treatments didn't work, but they were still willing to exploit parents. Now, that's a really hard thing for a journalist to prove because it's a state of mind.
And oftentimes it's actually not true when it comes to, you know, pseudoscience or especially alternative medicine. Some practitioners are straight up charlatans, but the more dangerous ones believe what they're peddling.
Exactly. I think in the article I used the word fanatic. And again, a fanatic is somebody who desperately believes in something. Mm. You know, so much so that you really can't change their mind by evidence. So, but that's what they tried to put on me. And as I say, the court went with them for a long time. But after 2 years and, with a huge amount of support from skeptics, not just in the UK, but around the world, I've won my case. But more importantly, there was a campaign involving skeptics and scientists and free speech activists and human rights activists to change the English libel law.
Mm-hmm.
It was so bad that people from overseas would come to England to sue other people.
Yeah.
Because it was called libel tourism. So there was a case of a Saudi billionaire suing an American publisher in London. There was an Icelandic bank suing a Danish newspaper in London. There was a Ukrainian billionaire suing a Ukrainian newspaper in London. Everybody would come here because this is where they knew they could win.
So scary.
So we campaigned to change the law, and it took another 2 years, but eventually we changed the law. So we now have a defamation law that's much more balanced.
Mm-hmm.
There is a right to free speech, but there's also a right to reputation. You know, we have reputations, and I wouldn't want anybody to kind of libel me. So we must have libel laws, but we need to balance it with that right to investigate, to discuss, and to criticize.
And truth needs to be a part of the law. You know, the idea that these statements are factual or they're intentionally misleading. I know that in Steve's lawsuit, our lawsuit at SGU, it just started before I joined with them. There is this component of, there's the question of free speech and the question of censorship, but there's also a question of intentional, money-making. Let's say that you wrote this book and you got royalties from the book. So did you say these things because it was an ability for you to make more money? And that starts to make things very, very murky. It gets very complicated. And I think that that's why they're working in the same aspects to try and push for anti-SLAPP legislation on the books.
SLAPP
because
SLAPP is a term we don't know in the UK, but it's a strategic limitation against public.
Sure. I'm going to go with you on that.
I learn a huge amount about law and libel law. So basically, people. That's when people sue others in order just to close down the debate.
Right? Yes, to get them to be quiet so that they can continue on their day. And it's a nuisance, right? Oh, this person is suing me. Or I'm going to sue them because they've got a blog and it's making my patients not want to come to me anymore. So, and that's usually what they'll... what they'll posit is this is libelous and it's causing financial harm.
Yeah. One of the things in Britain is that in the change in the law, it's much harder for companies to sue for libel. So the new law in the UK, in England and Wales rather, recognizes that companies are powerful and have great influence on our lives, and therefore journalists should be able to hold them to account without the fear of being
silenced,
taken basically. To court, you know, the drop of a hat. So those things are really important. We looked to America at that stage because in America, your free speech laws were much stronger than ours.
Mm-hmm. And, that's true. Really to protect speech more than anything at the level of the individual. But there are still mistakes that are made and things fall through the cracks. And so that's why there is that push there. I also know that as far as the SGU situation, although all of the rulings have been in our favor so far, so we had a bit of an opposite situation. We didn't have to appeal. Actually, the person who put the suit forward, Tobinick, is appealing the decisions now. We're not going to get anywhere near all of the money that we've had to put into this back. Yeah. Were you able to recapture all of the financial kind of destruction that you went through?
So it cost me, it's a lump in my throat now if I think about it. It cost me £300,000 over the course of those 2 years. And you win, so you say to the other side, you owe me my costs. And they then argue about everything. They say, well, you know, you had this meeting with senior counsel. Why didn't you have a meeting with junior counsel? You had a meeting on a Friday and a Monday. Why didn't you just have one shorter meeting on Friday? And they will question everything you spent money on. And so in the end, you typically agree to take about 2/3 of the money owed to you. So I was about £100,000 out of pocket. Now, the Guardian newspaper, I'm very grateful to them because they came to my rescue then and they sort of paid me back for what I was out of pocket for. They hadn't stood by me initially. But, you know, to be honest, they couldn't. You know, they were laying off journalists and I think their argument was, look, if we stand by you, then we're probably going to lose. And it's going to cost us £1 million. We're going to have to fire 2 more journalists.
And were you a staffer at the time, or were you writing kind of an opinion piece?
I was just writing an opinion piece. Yeah. So you know, the problem was with the law. The problem was not with The Guardian or other media. So they came to my rescue. But I still lost, I would say, over those 2 years, I couldn't travel. I couldn't go to book festivals. I couldn't write another book. So I lost at least a year's worth of work. Mm-hmm. And it's a kind of, you know, my wife is a journalist, so she was incredibly supportive. She'd had similar sort of threats in the past, so we were very, very strong over the whole thing. But it's a kind of thing that can destroy a relationship and just drive people to distraction and worse.
And it can destroy a career. You know, in many ways, you have to have so much fortitude to be able to fight back. It is obviously much easier to say it's not worth it. I don't have the energy. I don't have the funds. I just have to hand it over to this one, which is so sad that many people find themselves in that situation where they settle or where they drop it. You know, they retract the article. They do what they have to do.
And I'm writing for The Guardian. It's a national newspaper. And it's a big deal, maybe. But I got a call from a woman who had tweeted a criticism over a media company in the Middle East. Because they'd been late paying her. And then when they had paid her, they had deducted the transfer fee. So she was she did transcriptions of video material stuff for media companies. She felt she was just badly treated and shortchanged and paid late. And she tweeted it. And they sued her for libel. And she spoke to me on the phone. She was in tears. Mm. She said, look, I'm a grandmother. I've never done anything wrong in my life. And now I could lose everything. And luckily, my lawyer that I've been working with, Robert Dugans at Brian Cave, was doing a lot of pro bono work on various libel cases. And so he kind of went to her rescue. But it's a terrifying experience to go through. It's really miserable. But the good news is we've changed the law. And there were some weird things we've changed. There was one not so weird thing is if you write in a science journal now, you're almost bomb-proof. Unless you've been deeply irresponsible.
Sure. You know, and then the hope would be that the journal wouldn't have published. You know, there's at least some extra protection there.
The idea is that, you know, journals have peer review and some research is speculative. And so the peer review process coupled with the idea that we know research is speculative means that that stuff should be put out there for further debate and comment and criticism. Mm. Another area where the law changed was on the internet. Our law hadn't changed on the internet in 200 years. The internet hadn't been around for that long.
Yep.
the thing about the internet was that if I print a newspaper article about you, you have 1 year to sue. Mm-hmm. If that article goes online, you have 1 year to sue after publication. Except every time somebody downloads that article, The fact that it is being brought down into your computer and published on your screen, that counts as a fresh publication. And the one-year clock starts ticking again.
That's insane.
It is, but it was based on the Duke of Brunswick, who was in Paris in sort of like 1828. And he'd heard that somebody had written an article about him 10 years earlier.
Sure.
So he sent his manservant to London to pick up a copy of this magazine. And because it was a copy distributed from the office of the magazine to a member of the public, that counted as a fresh publication. And
which the Duke is of Brunswick. Fair. It makes sense.
And so the Duke of Brunswick could sue, and our internet law was based on that incident.
Which is insane.
Yeah, it's just so that now has changed. Our internet law is you know, also it meant that things like you know, who is responsible. So if somebody writes a blog, we had people who wrote some very brave and courageous and important blogs, and somebody would threaten them with libel, and they would say, well, no, you know, what I've written is true and accurate, and I stand by it. They would then go after the web host that was hosting the article, because they technically were the publisher. And the web host would say, look, you're giving me £10 a month. Mm-hmm. You know, why should I not just pull the plug on you?
Yeah.
Otherwise, I'm going to get sued. So, again, the new law takes into account who is actually responsible. Not allowing people to take out the weakest link. But,
yeah, because I think that is a common sort of tactic, right, during these lawsuits is throw the book at everybody along the chain. You know, I'm going to sue 12 different entities that were all involved in the publication. Some of them will get thinned out. Some won't have legal standing, but eventually I'll still have four solid cases, and then I can maybe make even more money. Or I have a better chance of having that article about me taken down, which is really dangerous.
That's it. You know, and you need to protect those people, especially when it comes to internet publishing, who, you know, web hosts can't look at every article. They can't scrutinize every article. They can't be responsible for it. And if you're a blogger, are you necessarily responsible for all the comments that follow?
Yeah.
If you moderate your blog, then you kind of do become responsible because you are deciding what stays and what goes. But if you don't moderate, then you're possibly in a stronger position. But then...
Yeah, a YouTuber, for example, has very little control over the things that are said about a YouTube video. And if all of those comments... You know, if libelous, that which happen every 5 seconds, libelous things are written in the comments of a video, are they responsible? I mean, gosh, it gets really complicated.
Yeah, but you know, just a huge thanks to everyone in America because you know, one aspect, you know, we had a huge grassroots movement in the UK, mm-hmm. But there were things like President Obama said, you know, if you're an American and you get sued in London, we now have legislation that says we do not respect English law anymore. Yeah. So those kind of things really made British politicians realize that there is something fundamentally wrong with English law that American law just refuses to even recognize. And people like James Randi and many others kind of were the first people to say, look, we're here if you need us. So that was really reassuring. JREF, President Obama, you know, I don't think he knew about my case in particular, but the thought
we'll
was there.
We'll say he did.
Yeah, we'll say. and just you know, every skeptic who kind of you know tweeted and blogged and supported.
It's absolutely incredible to think about how lives can really be changed and how fighting back within the legal system and having that grassroots activist movement can actually affect whole generations of protection for individuals. I am not privy to the ins and outs of it. I hear about it on the podcast every week. Steve gives us an update. I see what's going on behind the scenes of SGU. I'm very lucky that I don't have to deal with it at the level that he is personally right now or at the level that you did for those many, many years because it can be life-ruining.
Yeah, and James Randi went through it mm-hmm. and many others have gone
and
through it.
And many others before.
And there are stories now that are coming to light in the UK. Lance Armstrong story, amongst mm-hmm. many others, and stories of child abuse, where journalists kind of knew what was happening, and they couldn't write about it because the libel laws were so hostile to journalists and newspapers. So, you know, those changes were too late for things that happened in the 70s and 80s and 90s. But moving forward, hopefully, Britain won't be a way of silencing journalists around the world.
Would you consider that, and I know we're running low on time, but I think it's such an important thing to ask. amongst the top kind of prideful experiences you've had? You know, yeah. What are you most proud of throughout your career? You're still so young, but you have such breadth in your career.
How old did you think? No, I am.
Well, it's the mohawk that throws me.
Yeah, no, cute glasses. No, absolutely. It's one of the proudest things. I have a son who's now getting up to 7, and I sometimes two children. The 7-year-old was just a few weeks old when the law changed, when we were campaigning for the law to change. And he, you know, my wife was very heavily pregnant when we went to the Court of Appeal. and I can now show him some of the film, the footage. There were documentaries made at the time of what we were doing, and to show him the sort of things that were happening when he was just about to be born and just after he was born. Just about a month or two ago, I took him to a pub in central London, because in that pub, with the first stage of the case, about 6 months into the case, there was a preliminary hearing on the meaning of the words. Was I calling them fraudulent, or was I just calling them stupid and incompetent? And we assumed that the law would side with us. We thought it was absolutely plain. I thought they were wrong, but not fraudulent. The judge didn't agree. The judge just went against me in every possible way you could imagine. And so we planned a kind of celebration in the pub that evening.
No.
David Alan Green was a lawyer who was blogging about the case in great detail, and now is a very serious legal journalist. So he said, I said, no, there's no point doing this. It's miserable. You know, we haven't won, we've lost. Nobody's going to turn up. I don't drink either. So they said, no, we should go ahead. And it was amazing, because that night, it was a room as big as this room we're in now, which is quite a big room, and it was rammed with about 250 people.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Some people I knew, some people I'd never seen before. People like Richard Wiseman were there. People like Dave Gorman, a comedian in the UK, were there. Evan Harris, an MP, was there. Journalists from the BBC were there. Just a whole host of people came to commiserate, to show solidarity, and so on. And that's really, I think, where the libel reform campaign started, on that night.
Oh, interesting.
Because everybody in that room, and tons of skeptics, that is, the skeptics in the pub venue, to be honest. So Sid Rodriguez was there in terms of putting it together. So that's really where there was clearly a passion to do something. You know, we were angry, and Brian Cox, who people may know from his TV work, he was there. There was a frustration and an anger and a passion and a commitment to do something that night. So now, to this day, the Pendrell's Oak pub on Holborn, there's a little plaque which says, you know, this is where the English libel law changed due to this meeting that was held on such a day. So I took my, I've got two children, but only one of them can read. Took him there to see it. And
And he probably still doesn't fully understand, you know, the impact as he gets older. Just imagine this. Your son could be writing papers about you in his civics classes.
No, it's interesting. I mean,
crazy?
Weird. Well, I get asked to talk at law departments and talk to students who are being taught about journalism courses in terms of free speech and so on. And it's really odd that this case has appeared in our law textbook, which is what people learn about. So I obviously don't want my son to become a lawyer. I want him to, nothing wrong with being a lawyer, but I want him to be a scientist. So you know, that's a great, I'm proud of lots of things. The books I've written, and I meet people who now say I'm a math professor, or I'm a computer scientist because of the books I read.
Yeah.
Today, QED will have heard Britt Hermes, who was a naturopath, was a practicing naturopath. Studied it for 7 years and invested, I think, $240,000 in her education into naturopathy. And it was wonderful this morning to hear her say that when she read Trick or Treatment, the book I'd written with Edzard, but that's what made her realize this really was not a true profession.
Yeah.
It wasn't a true medical profession. So when you know that your work is having that kind of impact, and now she's not no longer a naturopath, but she is an active campaigner in that area and has a website called naturopathic diaries, I think. That's really fantastic thing to know. But the thing I really care about at the moment, the thing maybe a good thing to kind of finish on is the thing I worry most about is that if math is your thing, and by math I mean engineering and physics, and probably the more physical sciences.
Sure.
I don't think education in the UK and possibly in many other countries really stretches you. You know, when I was 12, there were some kids who loved literature, and there were some kids who loved music, and there were some kids who were terrific at sport, and I was pretty good at math. And I had an education that stretched me and challenged me and built me into somebody who could think mathematically and rigorously, logically, and creatively. And gave me an intellectual stamina that then helped me through my degree and my PhD. I think I had a really strong education in that respect. Nowadays in the UK, if you're 11 or 12 and maths is your thing, mathematics, I should say, you're not stretched.
Yeah.
It's just a walk in the park for 5 years.
It's definitely not a Western educational priority anymore. And you do see differences between educational efforts in the East and the West.
It's a priority. Mathematics is a priority, but the priority is that everybody should be numerate. Everybody should be competent. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Of course, yeah, that's absolutely necessary. But beyond that, that's true. There's not that many opportunities or options unless you're lucky enough to go to an elite school and you're lucky enough to, you know, your parents probably have money and they've put you into a department where that's really kind of fostered. But yeah, most kids don't have that opportunity.
So I've just started a project in 4 schools in England. Mm-hmm. Just started a month ago, 6 weeks ago. And the 12-year-olds, when they come into their secondary school, if they've shown an aptitude for mathematics, and we're looking at maybe the top 5 to 10%, they go into a special group. We're calling it the top set. If somebody can come up with a better name, that would be great. And they are going to be following a completely different track for the next 5 years at least. And the idea is to build them into strong, confident, passionate mathematicians. And I think it's going to be really important in terms of getting more women and more diverse communities into it, because we've got lots of girls in these groups, and what we're going to say to them is that we're going to nurture that ability, we're going to allow it to flourish and allow it to grow. And it's only been going for 6 weeks. The initial feedback is incredibly positive and exciting, but in 2 years' time, we'll be able to see whether this group of kids is achieving at a level which would not normally be seen within a school environment. So that's my big thing.
That's incredible. And ultimately, what that will lead to is other young women seeing these women in positions in STEM fields that show them that they can do it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the key thing. The moment they get their, we have an exam called a GCSE when you're 15, and loads of girls get A star.
Sure.
And that sounds great, but an A star in mathematics doesn't really show that these girls have been really challenged and stretched. And so we want to really make sure that boys and the girls and everybody who wants to do that. I was rubbish at languages, I was rubbish at literature, hated music, loads of things that I'm useless at. But the thing I was good at, I really needed that to grow. So on my gravestone, that's what I'd like. If that takes off and starts happening in every school across the country, that would be amazing.
Why not the world?
Yes, possibly. Right.
I think that we could benefit from that in the States as well. Simon, this was such a fun chat. We went way longer than I told you we would. So I'm definitely going to stop it now so that you can get back to QED, to having fun, to enjoying yourself. Thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you for coming to Manchester, and thank you for being part of QED. It's an amazing conference.
It really is. So far, it's been, I haven't had the pressure of being on stage. That all happens tomorrow. I've been able to just enjoy it, and it's been incredible.
Manchester, it's put on by a group of skeptics in Manchester and Liverpool, the Merseyside skeptics, and they've been doing it for several years. It's a world-class skeptic conference. And, if anybody wants to be here next year, then start looking.
Yeah, seriously. And with world-class people, there are so many great, talented people here. You are you know, you are one of them. I am so glad that you were able to take a little bit of time out of your schedule to enlighten my listeners. So thank you for that. And thank you, everyone, for listening and coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.